from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's time for a new edition of How Do You Do That? This hour, we answer questions submitted by Connections listeners, all under the theme, How Do You Do That? So this hour, we will answer the following questions. How do you dress for air travel? How do you know you've stayed too long at your favorite coffee shop, and can you get kicked out? How do you make an authentic Brooklyn-style pizza? How do you fill an inner loop? And if you're serious about riding a bicycle to work or riding a bicycle more often day to day, how do you behave on a bicycle at busy intersections? Well, Rochester is in the midst of what you might call a multimodal transition, and no, the automobile is not going away anytime soon. But the city is trying to make life easier for people who don't want to use a car all the time. Bicyclists at the top of that list. They want more people to feel comfortable riding a bicycle to work or to the store or out to eat. And if they're successful, that will mean more of us will be riding bicycles more often, and that will mean learning the rules of the road. Later this hour, as we talk about various themes of how do you do that, a city engineer is going to answer the question, how do you fill the inner loop? Because that's what's going on right now, and that is part of this larger theme of kind of a reconstructed city identity. So now let's talk about this. How do you deal with the intersection if you're a bicyclist? We've heard from a number of listeners who've said, okay, I'd like to start bicycling more often, bicycling to work, bicycling sort of functionally, but there are a lot of questions about just learning the rules of the road, approaching an intersection. And so I've brought someone I think is very well positioned to answer that. That's Shauna Lydon of Full Moon Vista Bike and Sport in Rochester. She's here. How are you, Shauna?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Evan.
You want to weigh in on the inner loop? Are you guys happy with what you're seeing there?
I am, as a city resident. I think it's a great way to join things together because it is kind of a little division. As far as riding a bike through the city, it's a little tricky when you have to cross over a highway. So I think it'll be a great thing.
How often are you bicycling? Functionally bicycling?
Functionally bicycling, I try to ride to work 2 to 3 times a week when the weather is nice. Mm-hmm. I have a car. I'm not car free, so I admit I'm a fair weather commuter.
Okay, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, most people I talk to have not said you must bicycle and get rid of your car. It's just a matter of, are we looking for ways for the opening to say, okay, I'm going to bicycle to work, like you said, 2 or 3 times a week. It'll be good for me physically. It'll be good for everybody else involved, the environment, et cetera. And so do you meet people who come in to where you are and say, I want to get started, but I'm a little concerned, a little nervous about getting on the road in the city traffic, rules of the intersections. What do you hear from people?
What you just said is exactly what we do here. We hear, I don't know, I want to avoid the really busy places. What's the best way to go? What do I need? What should I, how do I behave? And that's those are obviously some big barriers, but you can overcome them. You really can.
Starting where? I mean, what's the first step?
Yeah. Well, the first step really is to kind of be comfortable with your bike. As long as your bike is in good working order and you are comfortable and confident riding it, then you can start by riding around your neighborhood, get used to how you familiarize yourself with the rules, which basically are you should behave like a car. You need to signal with the appropriate, I'm turning left, I'm turning right, stop at intersections, stop at lights, stop at stop signs. And if you behave predictably, cars will respect you, or they should respect you, and you can feel comfortable that you're going to have a successful ride or commute or whatever. So
start close to home, get into a rhythm before you take longer distances.
Yeah. That's a very good place
What is the most nervous part for new bicyclists about approaching intersections, for example?
Well, I think one of the things that for every cyclist is nerve-wracking is do the cars see me? Because you can think you've made eye contact with somebody and it's not registering. So my general rule of thumb is I don't assume that they've seen me. And I will wait, and drivers will wave me ahead, and I put my feet down on the ground and say, no, that's okay, go ahead. And I try to behave just like I would as if I was in a car, like wait my turn at the intersection. Don't, assume just because one car sees you that everybody sees you. So that's the point where, you have to be sure that if it's your turn, great. But just make sure that everybody knows you're going through the intersection, because in the battle between a car and a bicycle, the car wins.
I remember learning to drive when I was 15, 16, and my dad saying, never assume when you're pulling out into traffic, never assume someone with a blinker on is actually turning until you see them start to make that turn. And I never forgot that.
Yep.
And this is a similar situation. This
yeah.
is a similar mindset, but maybe even more cautious
yeah.
simply because you're not in a car.
Exactly. You don't have that protective coating of a vehicle around you. And it's, you know, I think every cyclist has had close calls where you're like, wow. And in certain situations, it was completely out of your control. And in other situations, you say, wow, I think I probably could have done something differently. And I'm going to remember that because I don't want to repeat that.
It's happened to you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I more often than I would care to admit or tell my parents, because, yeah, it's the risk. There is risk involved with it. But one of our good friends at the shop, actually, he is a Dr. Scott McCray. He's an ophthalmologist and an avid cyclist and advocate. And he says, he's like, the risks of cycling are outweighed 7 times by the risk of sitting on the couch. So it's more dangerous to stay inactive than it is to get out there on your bike. So you just have to be really careful.
And when we talk about how do you approach an intersection, how do you learn to get comfortable on a bicycle, some of what you're saying might be spooking some of the listeners who've thought about this, because they're hearing you say, hey, everybody's had a close call. They don't want to deal with that. And I think, to me, it just sounds like you're saying, don't be defeated by that, but be careful.
Exactly. That's, you know, we try to be realistic and honest with people. But if you are careful and you are keeping your eyes, peeled and watching for everything, you can dramatically reduce your risk. And if there's, you know, there are times when it's going to take, you're going to move a little bit slower and you might not get through the intersection as fast as you would. But you know what? It's okay. You're healthier for it in the long run. But, you know, driving a car, there's risk involved with driving a car too. So yes, it's not a perfect situation, but the more people out on bikes, the safer it becomes for everybody, even in cars. There's something that bicycles have a calming effect on traffic in general. So if everybody is more aware of cyclists and there's more people riding, then it's good for all of us.
We're talking to Shauna Lydon of Full Moon Vista Bike and Sport in Rochester in the South Wedge. Is
mm-hmm.
that right?
Yep.
Where are you located?
Right on South Ave, right near the intersection of South Ave and Gregory Street.
Okay. And you say that bicycles have a calming effect on traffic, and I don't dispute that, but every time we talk bicycling on this program, inevitably, someone calls the show who says, I'm tired of arrogant bicyclists, et cetera. It's almost like there's this divide that can exist, hopefully not between all bicyclists and drivers, but there is a bit of a divide sometimes where bicyclists say drivers don't care about us and drivers say bicyclists don't obey the rules of the road. They're arrogant. I mean, do you hear that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there are times when I have been with people who have been behaving in a less than attractive manner, and
as a bicyclist and as
I've seen people as drivers do it, mm-hmm. because a lot of it from the cyclist point of view comes from the fact that you are vulnerable because you don't have a car around you. So if you are feeling threatened, you will react a certain way. And cars, a lot of the time, everybody's in a hurry. Everybody is trying to get to the next place that they're supposed to be at. And so that conflict results in some really unpleasant situations. So it's a tough spot to be in. And I have experienced both sides of it. But a lot of it is helped by cyclists behaving predictably and following the rules. And then also motorists, if they understand the rules and how bikes are supposed to behave, a lot of drivers don't understand where bikes are supposed to be and how we have to behave riding to ride safely. So it's a lot of miscommunication and lack of information out there too.
I am way dated on driver's education classes. Do driver's education classes deal with bicyclists on the road?
I'm way dated on that as well. I don't believe
they
do.
I think it should.
Oh, they absolutely should. I've actually had conversations with drivers, and conversation is putting it nicely, about where the legalities of it as I was riding. And I was explaining to people that, no, what I am doing is legal. And no, you are not allowed to make me get off the road.
You've had drivers tell you can't be where you were?
Yes. Yeah? Yes. Like pulled up alongside me and shook their finger.
Yeah. Really?
And the nice thing is working in the industry for the last 10 years, you absorb a lot of information. And there's vehicle and traffic law that says cyclists can ride 2 abreast as, you know, near the white line, and you are entitled to part of the road. And just because a car has to wait behind you until it's safe to pass does not mean that I am outside of the law. So a lot of it has to do with drivers just don't know, unfortunately.
Okay, but how is the city getting in terms of its approach to bicyclists, and is that improving?
It's improving dramatically. I work in the South Wedge. I live in the North Winton area, and the bike lanes and the sharrows and the different things that just bring bikes into people's consciousness has changed dramatically in just the last probably 4 or 5 years.
And you said sharrows?
Yeah, it's a picture of a bike with an arrow saying basically to drivers, there's going to be bikes on this road and you have to share the road. It's mm-hmm. not, they don't have to get on the sidewalk and they shouldn't be on the sidewalk anyway. So that visibility has helped dramatically. There's bike racks everywhere, bike racks in a lot more places. And it's been great. So there's a lot more coming and drivers are becoming much and more accommodating, especially in the city from what I've seen. So
you've answered the question, how do you do that? How do you approach an intersection as a new bicyclist very, very well? Let's at least close on that point with a question on sidewalks. You just mentioned it, because a lot of people will wonder, how do you ride a bicycle in traffic? Should I just get on every sidewalk I can?
It's not a good idea to ride on the sidewalk, because on a sidewalk, people, cars are accustomed to pedestrians on sidewalks. So if you are riding a bike on a sidewalk, you need to behave like a pedestrian. And that is different from how you would normally ride a bike. So you have to be really careful if you are going to ride on a sidewalk, and be aware that people will not expect that you're going to be moving that fast. You have to treat each driveway as an intersection and be really, really careful. So.
And finally, you guys involved in an event next month. What's going on?
The Rochester Twilight Criterium. It's an event that we did. The last time we did it was back in 2008. It's a really exciting event, basically NASCAR on 2 wheels. So you'll see be about 20,000 spectators down on a 1 mile course, where you'll have the professional races are the cap off the day and night. And it's a really exciting event, free admission, and it's just awesome. So the Rochester Twilight Criterium, Saturday, August 15th.
Have fun with that. And thank you, Shauna Lydon, helping us understand, how do you do that? How do you approach an intersection if you're going to try to bicycle to work more often? She is the Full Moon Vista Bike and Sport in Rochester. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Evan.
You might have noticed that Rochester is busy filling part of its inner loop. And in recent weeks, we've heard from a number of listeners who want some clarification into how exactly that's happening. So we've enlisted the help of Rochester's city engineer, Jim McIntosh, to explain where things stand now and what exactly is going on. It's maybe is this the most asked about subject in your line of work?
Yes, I guess I'd have to say, with the Port Marina following as a close second.
All right, so the Port of Rochester and the Interloop, and Jim's the guy who's always cautioned us to say, we're filling part of the Interloop, still it's just a third of it, but we're seeing a lot of work now. It's happening. What is happening right now?
Sure. So fortunately, about 6 years ago, we had a little bit of a practice run on filling an existing road when we filled the Broad Street Tunnel from Brown Street up to Main. And that was a similar fill. But with any of these, you basically have to start by getting the utilities where you want them. And so that was the first work that was done, getting all the utilities to kind of line up with the new Union Street that's going to be there, and the elimination of Pickens Street, where some of those utilities ran, so that when we have our 6 acres of developable land, we'll have a spot to do it. So once that work was done, now they can start the fill process. And that is very prescriptive, the types of soils, the compaction, the lifts that they have to put in. It goes in 1 to 1.5 foot lifts, gets compacted, gets red for density, and then they, you know, move up and try and get up to speed or get it up to grade. And I think the other big thing is maintaining traffic on those two streets while all that's going on.
All right, so what exactly is the stuff that we're seeing? You talk about fill material. What
sure.
is the fill material?
So the fill material is, and I say stuff, but it meets a very specific, gradation from New York State DOT, and they have, a bunch of numbers that go with that. And as you start at the bottom, the particle sizes can be bigger, 3-4 inch, and as you get higher, it gets a little, a little less, a little more sand and in the material, and that's just kind of the nature of, and you want to not have voids in it, so that when you're building the road and developing it in the future, you don't have any spots that settle. And so that's the whole reason for this: bringing it up in lifts, getting the right material, meeting these New York State DOT gradations. And there's a lot of testing that goes on before the material even gets brought to the site.
Can you explain again just a little bit about the sand? You said more sand is the higher we go, or less?
Well, I think as you get higher, what I would call less bony. It's, less of the big rocks and more of the smaller rocks, but still, material that's, 2 to 3 inches in size in the higher elevations, where you might have, larger stones, and boulders in the lower, when you first start out.
And when we talk compaction, that means you are making sure that it is sort of firm and you're not going to have soft spots. We've had a number of listeners ask just about whether there are concerns about future sinkholes or soft spots.
Sure, and that, that's always a concern with these types of projects, and certainly, we were thinking that on the Broad Street project that we would have at least some spot where we'd, open up, we'd have some settlement, but fortunately there we haven't, and we're using the same methods here, so, we're pretty confident now, having gone through it, and that project being 5 years ago, that by doing, the same methods, that we're going to get the same result.
Talking to Jim McIntosh, Rochester City Engineer, in our How Do You Do That series, how do you fill the inner loop? A lot of people, I think, probably noticed during Jazz Fest week, because they're walking across the East Avenue Bridge there. They got a beautiful view of it going on. They see it happening. Now you're hearing about what the material is. And the compaction process, it looks like you get a layer down, and then you sort of flatten it, then another layer and flatten it, process layer by layer.
That's it. And, you're putting it down, and then you're running a roller over the top of it. Then you get out there with your testing, make sure you get this, it's called a proctor test is the test that you use, and you get this 90% proctor. And if you get that, you move on. If not, you have to run the roller back over it a few times. That's kind of, the day-to-day thing that they're doing out there now, and they're coming up in some of those spots, particularly by the Broad Street Bridge. They're, starting to get up close to grade, and their hurry there is they need to get about 4 or 5 feet from grade so that Rochester Heating District, the steam line, can get placed and put in that fill and get off of that bridge that's still out there that's holding their steam line up.
How does the weather impact this work?
Interestingly, it does. You would think that the water might help, but all the rain we've had has actually slowed them down. Moisture content is certainly one of the things that you have to have at a pretty optimum spot to get this 90% compaction. The benefit of having these fill stored on the site is that typically what they've been able to do is scrape off the first 6 to 8 inches and get down to the material that's drier. It kind of acts like almost a shield, and then they just move that material off and dry it out so that they can, blend it back in. But it does have an impact.
Okay. Has it put you behind schedule? How is the schedule?
The schedule is still good. The contractor is anxious to finish, over almost a year ahead of our schedule, which is November of 2017. He would like to be about 90% done by November of 2016. And probably the next big thing that will happen and will tell us that he's meeting that schedule, and we certainly anticipate that he will, is taking down the East Avenue Bridge. And that bridge can't come down too late in the season. We don't want it out for the whole winter, so he's got to take it down at a point where he can finish that work and get the paving done before November when the plants close.
That East Avenue Bridge would be down for how long, though?
Now, that bridge will be down. Now, they're going to have the ability to compact the soil underneath it up to a point where they can't get the equipment, so they'll have already done a little bit of the work there. But I'm thinking it's anywhere from 45 to 90 days that they'll have it down. They're hoping to start that process sometime in late August, early September. And as I said, they need to be done pretty much before Thanksgiving. That's when the asphalt plants close, and they would want to have that street up and running again. And before they actually do that, they have to have Shallotte Street and Broad Street available as the detours.
It's good to know, just for those who use that kind of artery on a regular basis, because that will be a reroute for them for a considerable amount of time.
Right, and I think, you know, the reason that the plans called for them to have those two roads up and running is that the detours work out pretty nicely with the street still being one way. As you come into the city, you'll take a right on Union, a left on Shallotte, a left on Pickett, and make your way back up East Avenue. And as you head out of the city at night, you'll make a right on Picton, a left on Broad, and a left on Union, and get yourself back to East Avenue. So they're shorter movements.
In terms of the timetable, then, after that happens, you know, what's realistic? You kind of touched on 90% done by November 2016.
Right.
But what happens over the winter? Nothing?
No, they'll be able to continue to work along Union Street. There's some utility work, and the utilities actually are farther ahead than we thought they'd be at this point, and that's out of the contractor's control, so, you know, so that's great. And they can continue to work on, they have to keep the streets open, but they can continue to work getting things ready to reestablish Union Street as a three-lane road with parking and the bike boulevard, and getting the prep work done to take out the last bridge, the Monroe Avenue Bridge.
Okay. go ahead. We can edit that. You can grab a drink of water, and yeah, we can edit that out there. That's all right.
Good.
Sorry, that happens to me all the time. Usually it's live, though. Okay, so you did mention that, I think, Jim, that you say that, in essence, there haven't been the kind of hiccups, that you've been able to kind of get that 90% grade rating, and you haven't had the kind of things that would slow this project down.
Yes, we've been very fortunate. There was early issue with a pipe that had to go in first before we could start loading you know, the soil on top. But we had to move this storm sewer to get it out from underneath where the buildings would go, because we didn't want that complication. And we ordered that pipe, the contractor did, ahead of time, had it here in February, found out that the pipe didn't meet our spec. He had to order new pipe, and he probably lost about a month of time that he could have been filling in May. But he's caught back up, and is doing a great job.
We all want to get ahead of ourselves and then say, okay, what is going to go there? I know there's been some debate. Update our listeners as to how that process is moving.
Sure, that process is obviously handled by our Neighborhood and Business Development Group, but they have had a local firm, SWBR, come in and kind of talk about what those, you know, could kind of taken the plan that we did, you know, which was basically saying mixed-use development and, you know, kind of what you see on the website with the flyover, taking that a little bit farther and kind of drawing these zones where, you know, there's a zone around the Museum of Play that might be things that relate to that. There's a zone around East Avenue, which, you know, is similar to what we're seeing in the East End, all of them including retail or business on the first floor and housing, you know, up above.
Standing on where the East Avenue Bridge is now.
Right.
And walking toward the city, I mean, I remember walking in during the Jazz Fest, looking out to the right, seeing the compaction work happening.
Right.
When that's filled, it will be more road space, possible more green space, and then probably an opportunity to make it sort of cohesive to that neighborhood. What does that landscape look like to you?
Correct. I would see it that corner kind of being a focal corner and trying to look, you know, looking for something like, you know, what's at M&T on the one side and Arenas Florist on the other side. In fact, that was the interesting thing when I, you know, said, wow, this could be really different. When you look at that drive-through that we had done when we were applying for the grant to get the project, you kind of get to that East and Union intersection, and I'm looking over to the left, and I'm expecting to see Arenas Florist there, and there's this other building. And that's the kind of change that I don't think any of us are really ready for, what that's going to look like, that, you know, density that's going to extend all the way up East Avenue. Basically, you know, it's East and Union's going to look like East and Alexander, and, as you know, it's going to look like East and Broadway. It's going to be more of a denser urban thing and, you know, feel, and not have that look of a moat between the East End and the rest of East Avenue.
All right, two more quick questions to wrap up. As this is apparently going pretty well, what is the thought about future fill of the rest of the two-thirds of the interloop?
Sure, we're already starting to look at that and actually did look at it as part of, you know, this project. The difference between these two is 6,000 cars a day on the section that we're doing right now, less than what we see on East Avenue or Monroe Avenue, you know, two-lane roads, both of them. And as you get to Main Street, the numbers go up to about 15,000 to 20,000 a day. And so the treatment there would have to be different, but it still doesn't. It would be, you know, more likely a boulevard with, you know, possibly, you know, two lanes in one direction, maybe two lanes in both directions. That would be the difference, but we're starting to work on that now, and there's certainly the same reasons to reconnect that area and the public market area to downtown, at least till you get around to where, you know, kind of the railroad tracks make that natural barrier again as you, you know, work your way around the interloop.
When do you suspect we'll get a formal plan ready for that?
We're just going out to try and get funding for that design, so I would think we're a couple years off, and some of it's going to depend on, you know, where the traffic goes after this project happens, because that's the reason we couldn't do it before, is that, you know, we were showing the need for a triple left turn on University and all these other things, which, you know, we're just not going to do in an urban setting. We're not going to try and make it look like Jefferson Road at you know, East Henrietta, and so we think the traffic will disperse and we'll be able to have more of an urban, you know, feel and reconnect University Avenue as the way it was, you know, well before the interloop.
So Jim's answered the question, how do you do that? How do you actually do the physical work of filling the interloop? And my last question is this: you will never make everyone happy when you are a city engineer. City planners have to make decisions, and that's the nature of the job. But do you get the sense that the more this project unfolds and people can start to envision the end game, are you hearing positive feedback in that regard?
Yes, I think so. Even the folks that say it's going to, you know, extend their commute by a certain amount of time, I think they're starting, you know, they've found other ways. There's a lot of ways to get into the city, you know, from the what's remaining and 490. And I think they're starting to see those alternatives. And also, once the road is, you know, working again, I think that, you know, the amount of time that they're going to lose by, you know, having, you know, a couple traffic lights and that kind of thing is going to be offset by, you know, what they see in development of downtown.
There are plenty of days where this will actually extend my commute a little bit, but I also know that there's a good chance that this is going to impact a lot more people than just me, and I'm trusting that you're making a decision for the good of the community. So if it impacts me, but it's good for the community, I'm going to try to say thumbs up, and I hope you're right. So thanks for taking the time to fill in our listeners on this, to fill in. Did you like that? That's
punishing me.
Yeah. We'll talk to you again soon, Jim. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for having me.
I'm Evan Dawson. On the next Connections, it's Healthy Friday. We'll talk about the World Special Olympic Games, and we'll find out how New York State athletes will be represented. And we tackle the topic of painkillers. The FDA wants you to know about possible risks to your heart. We will sort that all out with my colleague Elisa Orlando. Talk to you Friday on Healthy Friday on Connections. Last week, the Washington Post ran an article titled, "Did You Buy That Latte 2 Hours Ago? Think About Leaving the Coffee Shop." The article told the story of a shop called Bread First, run by James Beard Award nominee Mark Furstenberg. Bread First is a very popular shop in D.C., and it's often hard to find a seat. So Furstenberg has taken to politely telling customers to get out. Seriously, if Furstenberg notices that a customer has been there with the same cold cup of coffee for 2 hours or more, and it's peak business time, he'll gently inform them that his shop is not their second office. And that led us to wonder, how do you know you've stayed too long at your favorite coffee shop? During the morning or afternoon rush, there are several Rochester coffee shops in which it can be hard to find a seat. One of them is Poor Coffee Parlor off Park Avenue, which opened in the spring of 2014. It's become a very popular place with plenty of regular customers, including me, and I confess I have referred to Poor as my second office sometimes, so I've invited Poor's manager, Leah Dalton, to explain. How do you know when you've stayed too long? Leah, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Evan?
I'm good. I should stop calling it my second office, I guess. is that insulting to you and the Poor staff?
It's not. In fact, we have outlets near every single table so that people can be as comfortable as possible there.
I cannot be the only person who jokingly refers to it as my second office.
No, you definitely are not.
Okay. So this story out of D.C., did it surprise you?
It didn't surprise me at all. That's definitely not the take that we want to have at Port, just because we want to give our customers whatever they want, how we can best serve them. But that definitely seems to be the feeling at most other shops I've either worked at or been to.
Okay. So have you ever kicked anyone out?
Nope, never.
Not for staying too long?
Never.
Monopolizing space?
Nope. I don't think anyone that's worked there has ever done that.
There has to be moments, though, where you kind of look around going, really? You're...
There is. Sometimes when all of the tables are taken up, and people have been there for like 4 hours and they got one coffee 4 hours ago, you kind of hope that maybe they'll share their table or give up their seat, but we don't want to make people uncomfortable, and we want it to be a space that they can come to and enjoy and do what they got to do.
What is the longest someone has stayed?
I think somebody stayed there for an entire 8-hour shift. From when somebody came in and opened, someone came in, and then they went to clock out, and that person was still sitting there.
What were they doing? Do you know? I mean, are they reading a book?
They were on their laptop working.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about etiquette, because if the question is, how do you know you've stayed too long? For me, if I'm at your shop and I'm there for more than an hour, I will order another drink.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't try to overload on caffeine. I need it one in the morning, one shot in the morning. So I'll get a decaf something, or I will order something because I feel compelled to, because I'm sitting there using your space. And I want to ask you, first of all, is that the right etiquette move, and how would you advise people on the etiquette?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that most of our customers are very courteous about that. They'll order a coffee when they first get there. If they're going to hang out for the day, they'll usually get lunch, maybe another coffee, something for dessert after, which that's great. Another thing is, if you're going to hang out for a while, I would recommend being kind of mindful. And if you see that the seats are filling up, maybe go up to a customer who's looking for a seat and be like, hey, I'll share my table with you, because, you know, then there's plenty of space.
There have been moments where you walk in and it's like you've got a 4-seat table and one person's
yes.
there and the place is packed. And that's, again, you're so kind to your customers, Leah, but that's kind of got to drive you a little crazy.
Yeah, and my biggest concern is that the new customers coming in, obviously they're just as important to us as the customers who've been there for 4 hours. So, you know, it's a hard balance of how to serve both of those customers well. We don't want to kick people out, but we want to make room for people coming in.
Now, there's a double-edged sword here. I don't want our listeners to think you can never go to Port and get a seat, because most of the time you can.
Yeah.
What are the busiest hours for you?
The busiest hours, usually in the morning, sometime between like 10 and 12, and then sometimes in the afternoon it's a little busy around 3. Other than that, you can usually always find a seat.
Yeah, I've come in the afternoon and it's jamming. And so I know you're not kicking people out, but have you seen it in other shops? This can't be the first. This DC story that got all this publicity can't be the first. There have to be some who will ask customers, are you going to order anything else? And if not, you know, are you going to get out of here?
Yeah, there definitely is. I don't know if that's true for any of the shops around here, but that's definitely a thing.
Okay. Any possible expansion plans for you? Because it's a good problem to have if it's hard for people to find a seat, but you want to do something to help them. So are you thinking about expanding?
Not in our current location. We did just add a patio, which is about another 25, 30 seats. So that has helped a little bit.
When you are a customer, are you a coffee drinker, by the way?
Oh, definitely.
I assume, but I've never seen you drinking coffee. You're always working. If you are somewhere else drinking coffee, what is your rule of thumb? If you are, because for me, it's an hour. If you're there for how long, and then you say, I've got to order something else, or I've got to get out of here.
Yeah, I think an hour is a pretty safe bet. If you want to order, you know, you want to stay there for 8 hours and you order 8 drinks, that's fine with me.
2 hours, I think, is where it starts to get excessive. So do you consider what's going on with coffee in Rochester sort of a hot moment? I mean, I look at, we've talked to the folks from Fuego, and certainly Joe Bean, of course, is kind of a trendsetter, and we're hearing other expansion plans. How would you describe the landscape of where Port fits in and what's going on in Rochester?
I think the kind of what's going on with the coffee scene in Rochester, it's great. It's really encouraging to see really good coffee kind of growing, and we're really happy to be a part of that. I think we all are kind of working together as a team, all the different shops, just to bring really great, good quality coffee, and we're all friends, and it works out really well.
And maybe some of us should take a hint once in a while, because you're not going to ever come out and say, you're not going to kick us out.
Nope. We won't.
Thank you, Leah. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Evan.
We continue with our How Do You Do That hour and our next question and answer. The question is, how do you dress for air travel? It seems like an outdated question, I confess, but I've seen an inordinate amount of of literature on this subject in recent days, including some people in the fashion industry complaining that when we fly, we are often slobs. So I wanted to consult the person I trust most when it comes to fashion. That's Helene Bienduti-Hofer. She's the host of Need to Know on WXXI-TV. She's also the owner of your own personal styling company, Journastyle. And I'm a big fan of your style and your work. So let's talk about this.
Oh, thanks, Evan. No, and it is very, very true. There are tons of blog articles. You'll see social media postings about this. What is proper airport attire? And if you go on, I love Pinterest. That's like my go-to fashion and style site because you can pin tons of different images. There are hundreds of boards, style boards, solely devoted to airport attire. So it's clear that this is important, and people put a lot of thought and consideration into this, and I think that they should. You absolutely have no idea who you could meet on a plane in an airport, and it's really something to consider.
Okay, well, certainly in past generations, air travel was considered almost something formal. I remember seeing pictures of my wife's grandparents and many others. They'd dress up in full suit and tie,
right,
and long dresses, and it was this formal kind of gala occasion. Now, I will confess, in just a few hours, I will be on an airplane, and I will probably be wearing something close to sweatpants, and I know that bothers you.
No.
But why? I mean, I want to be comfortable. So where do we draw that line? Where do you draw that line?
All right, here's the thing. I have been on a plane multiple times in the last few months. I have met incredible people who have been valuable to me, and in terms of great contacts for stories, great contacts for my business. My husband has been with me. We sat next to this, she's a motivational speaker, travels around the world. She was a great resource for my husband and for me. And she made a comment to my husband, and she said, I know I want to connect with your wife because I can see she pays attention to detail. She got up at 4 o'clock this morning and she put herself together like this. I know that this is somebody who I would want to work with, could work with, and would pay as much attention to detail in terms of the projects that I would want to work on with her. So that's just an example of that alone. You do not have to look like you are coming off of a glossy fashion magazine, off of a runway. I don't even think that's crazy talk.
Well, you always do.
That's really, really kind of you. I don't think that I do, but thank you for that. But you don't have to look like that, but you don't have to have your Sunday best, okay?
Okay.
But for women, for example, I think that you can be, and men, you can be fashionable and functional as well. And I always, in terms of tips, layers. Airplanes are notoriously cold to me. I'm always cold. And so why not, throw on a nice pair of jeans, right? We all have that nice pair of go-to jeans that we can wear for a semi, dressy function that we feel, okay, they're not my grungy jeans. They're not the jeans I'm going to wear out in the yard, but they are jeans that are presentable,
mm-hmm.
and you can wear them at the airport. You could wear them to a nice dinner. Nice pair of jeans. Slip-on shoes, right? You don't want to get buckled down. Shoelace is so difficult, rather, when you're in the airport security line to take that off. Simple, classic shoes you can slip in and out of. And then a nice dress for men, the shirt you're wearing, you've got this button-up top right now. Its button is undone. It's this kind of cool, chic look. The tie is, a little loose. You look great. This is the ideal attire, I think, for wearing for a man in particular for the airport. A woman, you can throw on a nice cardigan. I always say simple palettes. I always stick with black when I travel with one pop of color. And I try not to get bogged down in jewelry. I love my jewels, but that's another thing that goes off in the airport security line. Belts can be a problem too. So when you look at yourself and you feel good. We all know when we can look at ourselves in the mirror and say, I feel good. All right. I can go out like this, and it's a self-esteem booster. But if you look at yourself in the mirror and you question, okay, can I go out in this? Change your outfit.
And Helene is not saying we're going back to the 1950s.
No.
But you're saying that we've gone too far. And interesting that what you're saying is not just because, well, it's nice to look nice. You're saying there is something functional, that occasionally you do want to present yourself. You're in public. You want to present yourself in a way that is positive, that in sort of in a way sells yourself.
And let me, in another, this is just a story for the reason why I am the way that I am. My mom told me the story when she and my father got married, and my dad, was like, I gotta take the trash out. He had his pajamas on. He went upstairs, put a suit on, and took the trash out, okay? And again, not saying you have to do this, but it was a matter of, A, self-respect, and then also respect for others, respect for the neighbors. He wanted to present himself in a way so he would feel good about himself, but to also let the neighbors know, I care about you. And that's also when we dress in attire that is appropriate. It doesn't have to be ultra stylish, super dressed up. I'm not talking about name brands, labels. I like a bargain just as much
Absolutely.
As anybody else.
Yeah,
my
yeah.
gosh. But it is about that, just that classic, functional, simple look that's approachable, but also there's just this a nice edge to it where someone can say, who is that? And then you can say, I feel good.
How old were you when you watched your dad put that suit on to go out to take the trash out?
Well, that was before I was even born. My
okay.
parents, my mom told me that story about
oh,
my parents.
Okay, gotcha.
But I watched my dad. My dad had a condition called sickle thalassemia. It's a form of sickle cell anemia. Mm. So he was in pain just about every day of his life. Mm. And the thing about him, every time he said to me, Helen, I will dress up because it makes me feel so good. And my dad would on a weekend wear dress pants, a dress shirt, and sometimes a tie. And I know some people listening would say that's a little overboard, but it made him feel good. And he forgot about whatever condition he was in physically because he looked at himself in the mirror and he said, I look pretty fly. And that's what my dad would say. I look pretty fly.
Here's the part that really rings true with me is just the signal to the neighbors, though, that I care about you.
Exactly.
I'm not saying if I wear sweatpants on a plane, I'm trying not to respect people around
right.
me. But I understand the point that you're making.
Right.
And I understand what my grandparents would tell me about flying on a plane. And I understand the happy medium that Helen Biandutti-Hofer is aiming for here. And the last point I would make is this, especially because my wife has gotten to know Helen so much and appreciates what you do for people when it comes to helping them with fashion. I think people would be really surprised to find out how much you pay or don't pay for what you wear.
Oh.
So it's not about breaking the bank
Absolutely
on fashion.
Absolutely not. I'm the person who walks in the store and I will go straight to the sale rack. And I will find, I love bargains. I mean, my mom had me in a mall when I was like a toddler searching for bargains. She said to me, Helen, you can get one thing for $50 or you can get five things for $50 and you can make it work. She taught me how to mix and match and I love getting a good deal. And that's what this is about. It's like you said, you don't have to break the bank. You can get something that's perfect for you and you can feel good about it too. And it's good on your wallet.
All right. Well, I've still got a few hours to maybe
change
what I'm wearing.
Please, Evan. I will make you change your mind.
Helen Biandutti-Hofer is the host of Need to Know on WXXI-TV, the owner of your own personal styling company. It's called Jurna Style. And where can people find it, Helen?
They can find it on the web, jurnastyle.com.
Our final segment, as we answer some of our listeners' questions on the theme of how do you do that, someone wanted to know, how do you make an authentic Brooklyn-style pizza? And what does that actually mean? This is my favorite question of the hour because it gives me a chance to bring in a man with a great radio voice. He might have missed his calling. He didn't miss his calling because he's making what is, for me and my money, the best pizza in Rochester. It's been that way for a long time. It's a place called The Pizza Stop on State Street. And Jim Staffieri is the owner and the pizza maker. It's nice to see you in my digs. I'm always down at your place.
Yes,
great to have
is.
You here.
Great to be here.
Thank you for thanks for taking the time, Jim. And first of all, Brooklyn-style pizza. Well, where are you from? You can answer this question.
Family's originally from Brooklyn. Brooklyn-style, that's kind of not an accurate term. It's first of all, let's clarify one thing. It's not a Brooklyn-style or a New York-style. It's New York pizza.
Okay, so you hear that all the time.
Yeah.
So what is New York pizza?
It's following the tradition. My uncle started the business back in early 1950s in Brooklyn, and it's just following what he's done for the many years that he did it, and then my father got into the business in the early 60s. It's just following the tradition and respecting the tradition.
We all have an image in our mind of what a Chicago pizza
right.
is like. What is a New York pizza like to
New
you?
York pizza is a thin crust pizza, but it's not just being thin crust. It's the way the dough is made. It's the way the sauce is made. It's the ovens you use. A lot of people up here in Rochester now are going to a New York-style pizza, what they call. And that just means they're making it thinner. But it's not the same. And like I said, it's the dough and sauce are the key.
Okay, so without giving away the entire store, and again, Jim's from the Pizza Stop, and I'm not going to ask you to give your entire recipe.
No,
but
we can't do that.
We can't do that, but it's not just a thin crust. How can we go in a better direction of making a more authentic New York pizza, New York style pizza?
Well, first of all, I will give you one hint. It's a low yeast dough. There's not a lot of yeast in it. The idea is you don't want it to raise up a lot. And then after we cut it and roll it, it sits out for a bit, and then we put it right away. You don't want it to get too risen.
Okay. Otherwise, you start end up in Chicago territory.
Well, no, but it's just not the same. Then it changes the characteristic of the crust, and you know it's more to it than just a thin crust. That's okay. Almost a science.
Now, here's another important question that did not come from a listener, but it's how do you eat a piece of pizza, especially if you want to be an authentic New Yorker?
If you want to be an authentic New Yorker, you put it in a piece of wax paper, put the wax paper up around the crust, fold it up, and eat it. That's the way you do it.
Now,
you don't need a plate. You don't need knives and forks. You just pick it up, put it in a piece of wax paper, and you're on your way.
When you see someone with a knife and fork, do you kick them out of the pizza shop?
I should. But then I'd be losing half my customers.
Do you die inside a little bit?
A little bit. It's just not right.
Okay. It's a little too dainty for you?
Yeah, not dainty. It's just not traditional.
Now, what about folding the pizza?
Yeah. Some people fold it. Yeah, a lot of people fold it. I fold it. Sometimes I don't. I like to eat it halfway, then fold the remainder of the pizza up around the crust, and then eat it like a burrito.
Very nice.
It is, yeah. I kind of like the mixing of the crust with the everything else.
Jim Staffieri is the owner of the Pizza Stop in Rochester, answering our listeners' questions on how to make, again, it's New York pizza.
New York pizza.
The term Brooklyn-style pizza is what one of our listeners used. You hear that a lot, but you said that's not the right term.
Well, because, I mean, when you say New York style, you're referencing this is what we want it to be. You're styling it. But what we say is ours is original New York pizza because, like I said, we follow the traditions that date back to the 50s. The way we do it, we don't cut corners. We don't use conveyor ovens. You know, it's just the whole package.
Can you tell me a little bit more about growing up and seeing pizza made and what it was like for you?
Oh, as a kid, it was, you know, every kid's fantasy. You have pizza all day, you know, 24 hours a day. If you want it.
Oh, and you did?
We did. You know, my father made an excellent pizza in East Islip, and he was very well known for what he made. And, you know, as a kid, you don't really realize it's what you have, but, you know, we were able to eat pizza whenever we wanted.
Long hours for your father?
It was, 7 days a week.
And because it really is for you, I always see you there.
That's part of the secret. You have to be there.
It's tough on family, though, isn't it?
It is. Oh, yeah. It's caused a few wrinkles here and there. But it's what you have to do. You can't have a business like that, especially when you're dealing with food, that you're not there. Because when you're not there, you know, things don't always go the way you want them to.
When you opened 30 years ago, and even today now, and you think about what you ate growing up and your family's recipes, how much of what you're doing does look like what you saw growing up?
Oh, a lot. I mean, the same products aren't available, but, you know, product-wise, the way it looks and everything, it's very similar.
What's the easiest corner that you could cut but don't?
Cheese.
Cheese?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
there's varying qualities of cheese from cheaper to the more expensive, and we use the more expensive.
You use more. Yeah. You really see a difference.
Oh, sure. It's the taste and just the texture of it. Cheaper cheese tends to be more rubbery. When you know, if you start chewing it, it's like chewing on a, you know, rubber. Where the more expensive cheese, it just, you know, kind of melts in your mouth.
And before I let you go, I have to interrogate you on one thing. My colleague Veronica Volk loves your pizza. I don't know anybody who doesn't, and I'm just saying this. I'm not, you know, a paid endorser of Pizza Stop. It is fabulous pizza.
And so Veronica, I shouldn't write that check?
No. Veronica loves your pizza. She learned an important lesson about being on a cell phone in line. can you tell us what that lesson would probably be?
Yeah, the lesson is if you're on your cell phone, don't try to order. We won't take your order. I mean, some people think that's rude, and some people think we shouldn't do it. But when we had people coming in on their phone, pointing to what they wanted and then holding up how many fingers of what they wanted, I said that's enough. You know, if you can't talk to me for 2 seconds, then we're not going to take your order.
I love it.
I mean, you know, people call us names for it and don't agree, but that's what we do.
You've had people complain?
Oh, sure. Walk out. Someone said it was going to call the Better Business Bureau. Yeah. You know, they don't realize that they're being rude. You know, it's as if they came in and they were getting ready to order and I took out my phone and started talking. It's just not right.
Now, to Veronica's credit, she said she totally understood.
Well, as long as she didn't get mad and write a bad review about it.
She had a big smile on her face, and she was back, I think, the next day.
Well, that's what we want. We want people coming back. We don't want to chase anybody away. And, you know, if they don't want to come back because of a simple thing like that, well, there's not much we can do about it.
Good ideas for our listeners if they're making pizza at home. I think people like my wife who likes to try to make some pizza. She does a great job, but I don't know anybody who does it better than Jim Staffieri and the Pizza Stop. Thank you very much for coming in, and I'll see you down there. The new location on State Street, nice to hear it's going well. Where else are you?
We are in Greece in the plaza by Long Pond and Ridgeway.
Because well, you've been in Rochester for 30 years. How long in Greece?
They've been a little over 2 years.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So glad to hear that's going well.
Yes, it is.
As well. Thank you for taking the time to come in for us, Jim.
Thank you for having me.
And if you have a how do you do that kind of a question, you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. We try to answer your questions with some regularity, and we're always glad to hear from you. Thanks to our engineer, Valerie Labanca, intern, Caitlin Madison. I'm Evan Dawson, and whether you're listening on WXXI, WRUR, WEOS 89.5 FM in the Finger Lakes, WXXI.org, or perhaps the WXXI mobile app, we are always glad to make our connection with you. Next week, my colleague Scott Feibusch hosts the program. It's Connections Summer Book Week. You can follow along, in fact, read along with the authors. If you go to our website, you can find a full list of the readings that they will be covering next week. Have a wonderful week. This is member-supported public radio.